Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harp Song for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. We're on page 41, chapter 12. Every age must solve the problem of the Sphinx, and when it has solved, it must fall into the great abyss toward which all travelers were headed, according to Heine, who with his Christian mother and his Jewish father had become a convert to Christ, yet was one who never went to church and without resolving his dualities considered himself to be a wandering Jew. And the mounts that he would climb were both Mount Sinai and Mount Olympus, since he had been determined to cast his lot with the Greek gods who had already lost. He would always be embarrassed by the fact that it was not until a year after his birth in Dusseldorf that his loving parents had been permitted to marry, and so he had removed their marriage, up a year, and his coming into this world up a year to 1799, and then up a year to 1800, in order that he might be the first poet of the new century, which had been born out of the old. He became this dapper, well-suited, well-heeled, almost ethereal gentleman, whose eyes had been failing for some years, one already blind, the other curtained by the web of a cataract, and whose tall, sloped forehead ached with discordant thoughts, and whose long-fingered hands trembled as if they were trying to get away from him, and who, like a tree bending in the wind, in which he was determined to fall backward and not forward, was beginning to experience the signs of a dissolving spinal column and the many fragilities caused by the mysterious failure of his bones to manufacture marrow, the soft tissue of vascular structure that should be in the narrow cavities of man's bones, and without which he would see himself turn into a ghost. Like Frederick the Great, he found that everything German had jarred upon his nerves from the beginning of his literary career, possibly even before that time, as the true beginning had been so early that it could hardly be traced. When he had reacted furiously to the insults that he believed had been dealt out to him by other students in Berlin, his patriarchal adviser, Moses Moser, had chided him. He should remember that he was only an idea. Hegel had said so. He had understood when he first went over to enlightened France from the dark ages of Germany. He had been resolved then never to return to Hamburg, but for literary and economic reasons had not been able to keep the promise of permanent self-exile to himself, that the revolutionaries who had dreamed of the emancipation of downtrodden peoples would not live to realize their dreams of the dawn which was to come and which was in the psyche of the poet of the romantic quest who was Heine. With his unrequited love for his cousins, first for the beautiful elder sister Amalie, he considered that he had known her in a former manifestation of life, wonderful, second for the younger sister Therese, who bore in relation to the ideal that her possibly unreal reflection in a clouded mirror. They were the daughters of the magnificent mercantile and banking prince Uncle Solomon, whose lack of a sufficient generosity had made of Heine a rootless, semi-orphaned wanderer with a sense of being a ghost while he was alive. Where was Heine to find a resting place? In Germany, I could no longer stay, he had written just before going over to France, where he, who had been the martyr of Hamburg, would be the martyr of Montmartre. Still, in the view of many superficial people, nothing but a fool with bells. Very popular among old hamburgers. Had been his weaver's song regarding the strike of the hand and foot loom weavers, not only against the great power loom which was their rival and which was quickly aborted, but of which the spirit lived on. His often quoted lines read, "A curse on the fatherland, false and faithless, where shame and infamy flourished scatheless. Where every flower is broken in turn, where decay and corruption nourish the worm. We're weaving, the shuttle flies along the loom, whilst day and night we weave the doom. Germany, we're weaving your shroud and worse, the warp and the woof of a threefold curse. We're weaving. Heine had written his Germany, A Winter Tale, when he was suffering from an attack of almost total blindness, and the weaver, who was death, was weaving a shroud for him, who was already in some ways his own ghost. He was very grateful to his earthbound publisher for the dissemination that gave to his works, which were the children of his brain. Right now, as his forthcoming volume showed, and it was certainly to be no flash in the pan, quickly burning out as would be the mortal fate of the poor Swan Taylor Wilhelm Wittling's Wounds and Blossoms, and even in spite of the fact that he, with his uncertain spelling, was the resurrected Christ to whom Heine sometimes referred as his first cousin, one who fortunately had lived before the printing press and had been invented, and there had been no censorship to delete from a book on the problems of heaven all parts that applied to the world. Heine's cosmic but minuscular rage had been directed against those who would not permit the freedom of a poet of his revolutionary views to express himself and were willing to murder either him or his book. Indeed, according to numerous eyewitnesses regarding the hangings of French revolutionaries, when the author of an incendiary book could not be found, his book had been condemned to the fire in his place. Heine's call upon the enigmatic publisher Camp was one in which he must have wished to assure some immortality to the children of his brain, which in his publisher's self-serving estimation it would be shown increasingly as time went on, and Heine tottered toward his grave, were merely mortal and would not deserve to be brought out in a final edition when he who had been dying for so many years was really dead, and not because there might always be a poem from his hand when he was in his grave. His publisher's vow was that a mediocre rival deserved frequent collections, but that Heine's brain children were so very transitory that they did not deserve to be resurrected and redeemed. Another of the reasons for Heine's concern with the present and future publication of his work was that he was afraid to die and leave almost destitute as to worldly funds the dumb wife Mathilde, whom he had married after several years of jealous love of her, and at a time when conjugal relationships, always tentative, had ceased, and to whom he felt nonetheless that he owed his life and whatever happiness was his, and who had not the slightest idea of what his complex and many-leveled works meant, and attributed more importance to a fashionable bonnet and her pet parrot's jargon than to whatever revolution might sweep over all the nations of the world. When coming into Hamburg, Mathilde had been in a terrible accident at the dock. The pet parrot, who had been like the devil's own bird, intervening between the idiotic wife and her husband, and to whom she would listen in order to know what his always dying groans and grunts were, had suddenly flown off its perch and bitten the hand of the family member who was carrying its high pole through the fog, the result being that with unthinking reflex it had been dashed against a cobblestone, where its feathers had turned into a mass of bloody red and its brain had suffered seemingly mortal injury. But the injury had been repaired by a skilled bird brain doctor, who probably enjoyed a large practice among the human-sized bird brain parrots in Hamburg. After a few days of misery to her at Uncle Solomon's dinner table, where the French language was not welcome, nor was the parrot on its perch, be it even bilingual, the very vocal but dumb Mathilde had been sent with her bird back to Montmartre, under the protection of a bodyguard who her protective husband had hoped would keep her away from the German exiles in Paris, to whom she might give her easy and indiscriminate favors, although among them would be masked as clowns, secret representatives of the Prussian king. The original German laws had been written in rhyme. It was during the rule of the poetry-loving king, who knew that God was on his side, or ought to be, that the petty-fogging censors at the fog-bound borderline had turned back, as if it were incendiary, the communal or socialist magazine which, printed in England, carried German translations of foreign luminaries, whose works were not intended to throw a dreaming emperor off his throne. Their sparks, those of fireflies which had no heat and could set fire to no tree, were dead, whether dead or alive, in all the dark forest or spectral-ridden marshland. That which had given offense to the censors was a small advertisement of a new edition of Dante's Divine Comedy. How could anything which was divine be a comedy? How could it not be? Phew, okay. So now we're on to Heinrich Heine. Wait, Heine. Was it Heinrich or Heine? I need to look up who he is. Sorry, I still need to do that. Oh, where's his name? Heinrich? I think it was Heinrich Heine. Oh my gosh. Okay, I can see Heine, but I can't see his first name. All right, still need to look that guy up. All right. So it is... This is interesting to me because I didn't know that communism and socialism was going that far back. In the U.S., it's pretty much thought of as a Russian and China thing that was brought about during those different time periods. Like, what, 60s? Because we had World War II and then the 50s. Korean War. I think that was in the 50s. And then Vietnam, I remember, for the 60s. I know it had been going on for a long time, because back then it was one of the longest conflicts we'd been involved in. But, yeah, I want to say not until the Cold War that it really, like this, well, yeah. But I would say it was like 50s or 60s for America. So it's just interesting to me. And again, this all stems from a reaction to poverty for the masses and predatory capitalism, which has been around for a very long time, as if there has been a good capitalism. I don't know when that might have been. But this type of just taking over the poor and, you'd have to imagine this is before Social Security. This is before any kind of programs for people in the U.S. So we just don't realize it. We just don't think about it. It's ancient. It's not ancient history, but it's much more recent for us in the U.S. of where we would put the time frame of communism, let alone socialism. I don't even think there's a timeline for socialism. It's mainly the communism, focusing on Russia and China. So it's very interesting to me to see all of this taken much farther back for Debs, because that's still a very glossed over part of history for the U.S. Debs himself is. I know very little. I mean, very little of anything about him. Probably for good reason. I mean, on purpose. So yeah, it is really interesting to see all of it, all of that history, that it goes much further back than anything I knew about based on my going through the U.S. education system. So yeah, very interesting to me. Cool. All right. Now you know what interests me. Sorry, that didn't probably come out as clear as I would have liked it to. But anyways. All right. Thank you for listening. Bye.